You're listening to Policy Speaking. I'm your host, Edward Greenspan, President and CEO of the Public Policy Forum, and thank you for tuning in. We launched this podcast on March 27th, 2020, in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Nearly 2.5 years later, we're taking stock of how Canada fared compared to its peers during the first 2 years, and there hasn't been much stock-taking, yes, so one of the first reports is out, published today in the Canadian Medical Association Journal by authors Dr. Fahad Razak, Saya Shin, Dr. David Naylor, and Dr. Arthur S. Slutsky. And they review the COVID-19 responses from 11 nations, known as the G10. That's one of the mysteries of the universe right there. And they share how Canada fared in comparison to its counterparts. Those G10 countries are Canada, Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, Sweden, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And the rationale for those will be explained in a moment as I'm joined by two of the authors, Dr. David Naylor, Professor of Medicine at the University of Toronto, and Dr. Fahad Razak, Scientific Director of the COVID-19 Ontario Science Table, and they will walk us through the findings and what we can learn from them. Welcome to Policy Speaking, David and Fahad.
Thank you, Ed. Happy to be here again.
Thanks to be on.
Great. Well, very interesting study. And before we get to the results, maybe you could just take a moment to explain what you were trying to do, what you were trying to find out, and why.
So we thought that this was a really valuable time to look back on the experience that Canada had in the pandemic. Clearly, this has been extraordinarily difficult for our population, but it's been difficult for everyone globally. This was a global pandemic that affected all countries. And it is valuable now to ask the question, so how did Canada's experience compare to other countries that look like us? What can we learn from that as we enter the third year of the pandemic? So that was the goal of this analysis. And a lot of the challenge is to figure out who are the reasonable countries to make that comparison against and why, and what are the specific parameters about the pandemic, the societal restrictions, the economic impact, what do we look at and what can that inform on this next stage?
And those countries tend to be sort of liberal democratic countries like Canada with fairly advanced economies and advanced healthcare systems, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we decided ahead of time that the pandemic has affected countries in such different ways that if you just choose one country or another, you will directionally make Canada either look worse or better. If you compare us to the US, we almost look better across every measure. But if you compare us against New Zealand, we may look like we've had a much worse pandemic. So we thought, what are the criteria that are really important? And we said political and economic models, that's really important. So you can't compare us against an absolute monarchy in Saudi Arabia, where maybe the rules are not the same as the rules that we have in our society. Health system capacity is really important. So a lot of the pandemic required aggressive use of public health rollout for things like vaccines, and then the response for those people who got sick in hospitals, critical care capacity. So it's not fair to compare Canada to India, where they have much poorer resources. And then finally, population size is important. This was a population-wide pandemic, so there's a lot of logistical challenges. And people look at small countries like Singapore or Israel, and they say, what can we learn from them? In many ways, that's not a reasonable comparator for large, complex countries like we have in Canada or the US or the United Kingdom. So we picked those three criteria, and then we asked the question, what is the largest grouping of countries that fits those three things being similar to Canada? And we found the G10 as the largest reasonable comparator.
Right. Okay. Not the best known group, but a good comparative group. People know the G7 and G20 better. But David, do you want to just add to this?
Thanks, Ed. I would add that going with a predetermined grouping, even one that's a bit obscure, like the G10 that's actually 11, is helpful because it avoids, as Fahad said, the question of selection biases and gives you something that at least is predetermined and has a little bit more validity in that sense. The second point I'd make is that we did do sensitivity analyses. They're reported in supplemental material online in the publication that looked at the G20 and just tried to get a readout on what different comparators would look like. And the results were pretty robust with other comparators. The last comment I'd make is that we did go forward 2 years roughly from the time the WHO declared a pandemic. So we don't pick up all of the Omicron tsunami and certainly the wave train that followed it. So that will be the next paper in what I think is going to be a couple of these that we do in follow-up. We're probably looking more depth at economic measures. We'll certainly want to see where we are at some point further along. But as Fahd said, let's take that early look with those first two crucial years where so much happened and so much of the response occurred, because that's where we can start to pick up some lessons about the future. And also, I think, start to address some of the revisionist history that's happening right now. It is people look at the Omicron wave or tsunami with all the breakthrough infections, and we're starting to say, vaccine mandates were useless. The vaccines are useless. It's an inflection point where we want to avoid that kind of retelling of the story in a perverse way.
Okay, so still, despite not picking up the whole Omicron wave, there's a lot of insight here. So let's start at a kind of high level, although you guys can dig down as deep as you like on health measures. Fahd, how did it do on health measures compared to the 10 other countries in the comparison?
We did really well. So I think it's worth noting that we, across the board, when you look at the engagement of the population in vaccination, we were at the very top of the G10 in terms of our two-dose vaccination rates. And then the direct effect of the illness, so the number of people who got sick and the number of people who died from COVID-19, we had among the lowest rates of infection. We had among the lowest rates of people dying. And we even looked at a measure called excess mortality, which is a really important composite measure. So there are people dying of COVID-19. But you can imagine when these restrictions occur that there's a lot of other problems, and those could lead to higher death rates. So, for example, social isolation leading to more substance use and overdoses, or missed cancer screening because people are isolated. And those things could plausibly lead to increased mortality. So there is another measure we looked at, which was the total mortality that Canada experienced. And again, compared to the G10, we were on the very low end. Now, there is one country which is a notable exception, which is Japan. So Japan had just dramatically lower rates of infection and lower rates of death and lower rates of overall mortality compared to all other countries. This is a bit of a mystery. It's an active area of study. To the best that we know of, it's not because of vaccination, because they are actually similar to the other G10 countries. It's not because of public health restrictions, which were among the most lax of the G10. It's for other reasons that are being studied. There could be stable genetic differences in the Japanese population. They're an island. They may have had prior coronavirus infections, which gave them some immunity. And they are culturally just better at wearing masks. This is something that has been done in Japan even well before the COVID-19 pandemic. And so people may have just done that more readily. So Japan's important to look at for study, but we think the other countries become the big comparator set for Canada.
Let's come back. We'll talk about mask wearing in a few minutes. But David, maybe we could talk about the Canada's vaccine record, because study shows it wasn't particularly auspicious to begin with, but it then moved into hyperdrive. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's a very interesting story, because there was a lot of impatience and frustration with the slow rollout. That first quarter was a high anxiety period in 2021. And I think we all remember other countries were zooming ahead. We were worried about supply. We were haggling to try to get the Europeans to give us what the Americans wouldn't give us. Real sense of our vulnerability, Ed, because we didn't have domestic capacity. And then the various advanced purchase agreements kicked in. It's clear the vaccine task force gave great advice to the government, and Anita Amanda's procurement minister and her team followed it to the T, and we ended up with a very good portfolio. The most important thing here that I would emphasize is, well, due credit to the federal government for procuring a good assortment, wisely chosen. Due credit to all the provinces and territories that rolled out these programs. Canadians were fantastic at putting their arms out and getting these shots in record numbers and record time. And we shot from being laggards to leaders quite quickly. That was a real key point, I think, in how we did overall, in addition to being pretty stringent in that first quarter when the first wave or two occurred. We were careful then. And then when the vaccines came, we started slow, but really caught up and overshot.
I think maybe there's two things that are worth reflecting on there. And that's, as you say, you know, Canadians did stick out their arms and they did get their shots. And I think there's so much focus now is on the people who did not get their shots as opposed to the very large numbers that did. But I think we were also caught surprised and unaware in some ways as a country that we didn't have the capacity and that we were left scrambling. Is that something that we should have been better prepared for?
Hindsight's so easy, Ed, but I think the answer is yes. We haven't had much of a coherent life sciences strategy. We've had reports recommending that we go that direction, that we couple it to our universal healthcare system, which is now in a bit of disarray, as we all keep hearing and know. This whole sad story about how Canada lost vaccine leadership and capacity, the story traced back to the early Connaught labs. All I can say is I'm encouraged that there seems to be a real commitment to try to rebuild capacity, both in terms of the research substrate and in terms of the manufacturing capacity now. But very unpleasant, somewhat dangerous period when we didn't have the capacity to manufacture and we were scrambling, managed to get a lot of shots into the arms of seniors, the most vulnerable, which was the right thing to do, particularly those institutionalized. But I think we should have been better prepared. It's, as I said, it's just easy to do the Monday morning quarterbacking at this point.
Now, you measured several things in the health area. I noticed, and maybe you could just explain if this is actually a bad measure, why is hospitalization rates not one of the measures of HOD?
Yeah, so hospitalization rate is really important, but it's not routinely collected across these countries in terms of the number of people brought into hospital on any day. So there wasn't good comparable data on that. There is a census measure, which says the number of people who are in at any time. But the problem with that kind of data point is there's both things coming in and people coming out, either being discharged or dying in hospital. And so that the question that people want to know is how many people were admitted to hospital each day. That statistic is not routinely available for comparison. But that said, the measures that we have kind of cover the gamut of the disease in the sense of we have the infections, which is everyone infected, which includes many mild infections. And then you have on the very other end, you have the deaths, which is the most severe. So you've covered the spectrum in some ways, even though you're missing that crucial part in the middle, which is the hospitalizations. And it would have been really important because David mentioned the enormous sacrifice and I would say engagement and rallying of the Canadian public around this pandemic in a way which is really admirable, especially when you see the comparison against other countries. But also the hospital part is a really important part of the story, because if you look at the entire OECD, so a much bigger grouping of countries, Canada's at the very bottom of these countries in terms of hospital capacity per capita and critical care capacity. So when you have this kind of population-wide pandemic roll through, which you see Italy's hospital sector collapsing, New York State, it's collapsing, the worry among all of us is, oh my God, what's going to happen to our hospitals? And you had this enormous rallying of healthcare workers and hospital leadership. So you had people working extraordinary number of hours to keep our hospital system afloat, the primary care that supported on the outside. And then you had this unprecedented transfer of patients. So in Ontario alone, at the peak of one of the waves, you had more than 4,000 patients transferred between hospitals in order to load balance the volumes that were coming in. That's never happened in our country's history. And it was done on the fly in the middle of the pandemic very successfully.
Just an anecdote, Ed, about how real time all this was. In that first few weeks early in 2020, when everything was being shut down, you had groups of plastic surgeons saying, we often have ventilators for short stay surgery in our clinics. We're willing to put them in play. They can be repurposed for hospitals to increase ICU capacity. Dental offices or dental surgeons were saying the same thing. So there are conversations happening as health professionals try to figure out how they could make sure we had extra capacity. Art MacDonald, the Nobel laureate, and a group were working on using some of the prototypes from other countries to create ventilators quickly that could, again, reinforce our capacity, and running into the irony that we have different standards for ventilators across different countries, which, you know, is kind of an intriguing comment on human upper airway anatomy, which actually doesn't vary much. It really was a sense of scrambling in real time to make sure we had what we needed, because the stores on all these supplies, including ventilators, were of uncertain avail. As Fahd said, we did okay, but we were stretched perilously a number of times, and a good equilibrium was eventually found. But boy, talk about a stress test for healthcare and for the fantastic people working on the front lines in it.
Okay, well, in a couple of minutes, I'm going to come back to the economic piece and the public health measures, but I just want to stay with where we are. There's an interesting point in the study where you talk about just how it could have looked if we had records that were similar to countries that were behind us in different measures. You compare it to France and its infection rate, if I remember correctly, the United States, its vaccination rate. Why don't you just walk us through if Canada had a bit of France in it, if Canada had a bit of the United States in it. And I'd also want to do it on the flip side, maybe if Canada had a little bit more Japan in it, what it looks like.
Yeah, so this is an important takeaway for us in that as a country, and this is natural, I think, we experienced the turmoil very internally. So we saw the restrictions, we saw people getting sick, and it was awful. It was awful for Canadians. But this was awful for everyone. And this between country comparison and numbers starts to put a little bit of a perspective on what happened here. So for example, if you look at the number of people who would have been infected if we had the same infection rate as France, even before Omicron happened, probably about 9 million more Canadians would have been infected if we had the same infection rate as France. For a country of 38 million people, that's extraordinary. And if you think about the disruptive effects on people's family lives, the businesses that they run or operate or work at, and the risk of developing post-infection complications like long COVID, 9 million more people infected is an enormous number.
Just remind us how many people were infected.
So in Canada, it depends on, I would say right now, you have to assume that more than 50% of the population has been infected because we've just gone through this Omicron wave where many people, including myself, who are triple vaccinated, became infected in this wave.
So you're saying 18 to 19 million people, 20 million people approximately, you know, at the upper level were infected, but another 9 million would have. I just want to put that 9 million in a context. I mean, you know, it's almost a 50% increase or perhaps a 50% increase in infections.
Yeah, the way I would look at it is, so the Omicron wave hit after many of us were already vaccinated, and we know that the long-term effects like long COVID are going to be, there's going to be less of it if you're vaccinated before you get infected. We know that now. There's good evidence around that. The 9 million number is really important because many of those infections happened before our population was properly immunized and protected. And the number there is 9 million out of 38. So roughly 25% of our population would have been infected before they had the full level of protection that we can give them now with three doses. And even if 10% of them develop long COVID, we're talking about a large number of people in our country that would have had persistent disability, trouble working, trouble with family life because of infection. And then all of the spin-out effects, you know, you're seeing Air Canada cancel a bunch of flights. You're seeing at many hospitals, they can't run their MRI machines overnight. These are staffing shortages and burnout and fatigue. Imagine the effect if 25% of our population additionally had been infected in those first 2 years.
David, do you want to just compare for a moment the other major comparison there, which is a vaccination rate? If we had a U.S. of vaccination rates?
I'll leave that to Fed. He's on a great roll. Fill in the next one.
Yeah, the next two. So there's two other important ones here. So there is vaccination rates. So again, up to the first 2 years of the pandemic, vaccination rates. If we had the same rate as the United States, which at the end of the 2 years was sitting in the mid-60s, so about 65%, we would have had about 6 million fewer Canadians would have been vaccinated in those first 2 years. Again, that's an enormous number. And again, to David's earlier point about the investment and engagement of Canadians just shows you how different our population was around this. You're never going to get 100%, but 6 million more Canadians went out and got the jab. That's a huge number. I think probably the biggest striking number is deaths. So if we had the same death rate directly from COVID as the United States, we would have had at least in the first 2 years, about 70,000 more Canadians would have died. Let's put that in a personal context. Each of us probably would know an elderly member of our family, a grandparent or an uncle or aunt, a friend or family member who's immunocompromised. We would probably all personally know someone who would have died if we had the US trajectory that is alive in Canada today. So that's the personal impact of this.
Just to elaborate on one point there that's crucial. And back to Bud's highlighting of the time scale of the period we looked at. You're talking about a period when for a fair bit of that time, the population was not vaccinated and we had real challenges. We didn't have antivirals that were very effective. We were still struggling along with steroids. They were a godsend, but that was about all we had and other supportive measures. So you look at how important vaccines were in terms of changing outcomes. And also that in that period, there was a strong limitation of infectivity, which obviously Omicron blew through. So a substantial difference in vaccine uptake is a big part, key part of the death difference between Canada and the US. Vaccines save lives.
Let's just talk on the other side of the equation for a moment. You mentioned earlier about Japan, Fahad, that one of the differences was a culture that was accustomed to masks. And we mentioned several factors, obviously, but I want to hone in on that one for a second. So initially, Canadian authorities were very dismissive of people having masks. People were discouraged, I would say. I'm sure that, in retrospect, was a big mistake that we made and made us different than perhaps the Japanese in that way. Is there any way to determine how much impact that mistake might have had?
Yeah, I think it's an important question. So we haven't looked at it here. Clearly, we underestimated the aerosolized nature of the virus, and that was a late recognition in Canada and in many other countries. Were we different than the bulk of countries? I don't think we were different, but it doesn't excuse the dragging, delaying nature of the recognition of the aerosolized spread. There are still signs up in the mall or other places that will say, wash your hands to protect against COVID. Washing your hands is great. Keep your hands as clean is great. But the recognition that much of the viral transmission is happening not directly through your hands now, but by breathing in either large droplets or aerosolized droplets is now, I think, pretty conclusive in the medical literature. So the messaging around the lack of needing of masks, was it wrong? Probably. Was it pragmatic? I think is a separate question. So you have to remember that the decision was made with the best available evidence that was around at the time around how COVID was spread and unprecedented constraints in personal protective gear that were occurring so that even we in a hospital, I was a frontline clinician in a hospital caring for COVID patients through every single wave, we were running out of personal protective equipment, including masks, including face shields. And so if you go out with incomplete evidence to say everyone should start wearing masks at the same time that the system that is caring for the sickest and have the people who are at the highest risk because we are leaning over patients who are actively spewing virus as they are coughing and doing procedures, there are other problems that would have emerged if that recommendation had occurred. So there is no right answer here. You know, everyone describes the pandemic as a series of wicked problems. This is one of them. From a purely precautionary approach, that recommendation of masks probably should have happened earlier, but there are these pragmatic problems that occurred as well. I would love David's thoughts on this.
I'd sort of look back to 2003 and SARS, where early on we were concerned that this certainly had serious aerosolized elements. We saw it obviously with intubations in ICU patients, but that was flagged early with COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2. But we also had some clusters, and the clustered nature of some of the cases was a real signpost of airborne transmission. The one in the funeral home in Newfoundland was really. We saw stuff on cruise ships. We saw choir practice in Washington State where there was widespread from singing at close range. This wasn't someone who was ill. We had a lot of signposts. When SARS-1 was done, WHO was still saying it was droplet-borne. I remember working on the sort of post-mortem the summer of 2003 and sort of grinding my teeth over the fact that the official verdict was this was droplet-borne. I thought it was mixed even then. So there's been this kind of droplet dogma that ignores 30 years of research on the physics of respiratory diseases. Influenza pneumonia is associated with aerosolization. And this is a disease where we saw ground glass x-rays early on. It was pneumonic. It wasn't all upper airway. I think we were slow to pick this up. The debate, of course, like everything in this blasted pandemic, became intensely polarized. It was either droplet or it was airborne, one or the other. And that, I think, got some people dug in and made it worse. So it's not a pretty picture, Ed. The last thing I'll say is it's not just a culture of mask wearing, although I think that's important. East Asian countries are a lot smarter about wearing masks in flu and cold season generally, and we should be doing that certainly this fall. We should be anything that's an influenza-like illness or a cold, upper respiratory illness, put a damn mask on, please.
I think we have a mask culture now. I think that would be a big change in the country. I want to take just 2 minutes, because you talked about economics, to talk about economics and then get into what I think is a very interesting series of points about the public health measures. But Fahad, you guys are scientists, you're medical health people, but you decided to put some economic measures into the study and the comparators. Why did you do that and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, we very gently put in some economic measures with some guidance from a colleague of David's, Professor Krasinski, who's an economist. Because a pandemic that causes dysfunction and disarray in every element of society, and these dramatic constraint measures like the business closures and the school closures and others, you can't analyze it through the narrower lens that we're used to, which is a health system lens. That's just an incomplete analysis here. And you have to consider broader societal effects, of which, of course, the economy is pivotal and central when considering societal effects. So we brought in measures that were frequently discussed measures that we thought would be informative and measures that had been serious pain points for Canadians, things like inflation, unemployment rates, and then widely used macroeconomic measures like GDP and debt spending. This is a very surface level analysis. This is the kind of analysis that requires much deeper dive, which we hope will occur. But that said, I think there are some concrete takeaways, even at this surface macro level, that you can take from this. So let me start with inflation. There was a Globe and Mail article about the inflation rates just this week hitting another peak that hasn't been seen and it hasn't been recently seen. And clearly, all of us are feeling that inflationary effect on every element of our lives right now. But I think the story that you see when you look at the analysis again across a broader range of comparators is that this is a whole of world effect right now. Every country is experiencing blistering inflation. And Canada, in terms of our inflation rate, is fairly middle of the pack of what we're experiencing compared to other countries. Same thing with unemployment. There was unemployment surges that occurred during the pandemic, but Canada's experience was relatively middle of the pack compared to most other countries. And as you know, unemployment rates actually have dipped quite considerably over the last few months. So after our analysis period, but they're continuing to go down. Same thing with debt spending relative to GDP. We spent a lot of money to keep the economy afloat and a lot of the pandemic measures during the first 2 years. Our total debt to GDP ratio is roughly middle of the pack, even though we spent a lot of money.
Just take the other part of that, because obviously we started with the lowest. So what was the growth factor?
Yeah, so the growth factor was on the relatively high side in the top third of GDP countries. In terms of the new spending that was put on top, the total spending level that left us with at the end of the pandemic layered onto our prior existing debt put us roughly middle of the pack. Now, one notable exception here, which is GDP. So GDP, obviously a very complicated measure, but our GDP contraction, in fact, where other countries had growth, put us at the very low end of the G10. So we had the biggest contraction of our total GDP compared to all other countries. That's important. That clearly is going to have some legacy effects in society and can't be ignored in this holistic analysis.
Okay, so let's move on to the public health measures, which have been the subject of so much polarizing debate in the country. You say at one point in the report, and I quote, some of the most restrictive public health measures across a broad range of domains that Canada had, some of the most restrictive public measures against a broad range of domains. And then you talk about school closures, internal movement, cancellation of public events, restrictions on public gatherings, workplace closures, and international travel controls. So what was going on here, and was it justifiable? We seem to be a bit of an outlier there. David, I'm going to start with you and then go to Fahad, okay?
We're certainly at the upper end in terms of the sustained restrictions, you know, ranging from restrictions on public gatherings and school and business closures. I think that the challenge is that there's another dimension to the measurement that is intriguing. We were more consistent. The Canadian middle way was to squeeze more or less continuously with minor let up than minor clamp downs, if I can try to provide an analogy. Other countries tended to pivot a bit more up and down. We saw that in places like the UK, where it was severe lockdowns 1 week and then open sesame. It's very hard to know which is better from a social standpoint. You have to worry that the whipsawing did no good because the mortality outcomes seem to be worse in countries that followed that pathway. But our steady, severe restrictions would be counted as one of the two factors in our success, along with vaccines. Inferences they're shaky here. These are ecological data at a very high level. If we could rethink this, would we have done less? Would we have been more variable, more open on the one hand and closed at other times? I don't know, but I do think that the main takeaway is the public's had enough of this. We've all had enough of this. We need to be smarter over the next few months as we hope the pandemic continues to wane, and that's still a hope, about limiting the restrictions to the minimum necessary and relying on measures that don't require the same degree of intervention at the individual level. Example, better ventilation. if you're going to restrict anything, well, maybe masks are okay, but let's try to keep things open and keep society going. I think that's my takeaway. I don't know what Fogg thinks.
I would just add, I think David summarized it well. What I would add is we are at the point where we can take the objective, which is reducing viral spread, and then trace backward and say, what are the minimum steps required in order to achieve that? So the hammer earlier in the pandemic to reduce viral spread was shut down public gatherings, shut down schools, shut down businesses. Well, we know that viral spread is predominantly via the air now, and we know that there are very effective control mechanisms that will reduce that, like improving ventilation, filtration, and sterilization. The technology and the availability has dramatically increased in the last 2 years. And it doesn't just help with COVID, it helps with influenza. Better air quality is linked to better cognitive performance on objective testing. So improving air quality has a lot of benefits. And importantly, it is a mechanism that reduces viral spread that allows important societal things that we need to not shut down in the same way that we have the last couple of years continue, keeping our business open, keeping schools open. The same thing with masks. So you can go to school in a mask. And we know that because East Asian countries have been doing it for decades. You can keep businesses open, malls open, and stores open with masks. Sure, you can't go to restaurants in the same way, but this is the compromises that we will have to make. So maybe we say we put masks on wherever you can continue your day-to-day function during these periods of high viral spread. And we accept that there's certain risks, like things like restaurants where people will take masks off for the hour that they're having lunch or whatever they're doing. And so the smart and nuanced approach means you keep society and these important parts of our economy functioning while achieving the objective, which is reduced viral spread. And of course, there's other things like vaccination and being up to date on vaccines that will contribute to that. So we think there's a portfolio approach that you can take here, which will keep you away from the harsher restrictions we've experienced.
To have done that early on was not feasible. All this makes so much more sense now that we have vaccines, a very heavily vaccinated population with more, I'm sure, to come as we get new vaccine platforms. And we have antivirals and monoclonal antibodies in some cases for preemptive intervention. It's a very different playing field now. But to have gone with this kind of open sesame approach early on, as some advocated, would have been a disaster.
Let me just put it in my words for a second. Tell me if I'm quoting right. And then we're going to sort of look at the lessons applied moving forward. But if I've got you right, we had perhaps the most restrictive public health measures in the world in many respects, school closures second highest, many other aspects. But despite some excesses, we got a return on investment in better health performance. Is that what people should conclude from this?
I think that is our, without doing the XY analysis to say X caused Y, that is the takeaway with all the limitations that you have with this kind of data. But that is our best interpretation of what we're seeing here, which is that restrictive measures that affected the population in a pretty profound way, highly engaged population that got vaccinated, serious benefit in terms of the burden of disease relative to other countries. That's our broad takeaway from this. And we think that is sort of the touch point to then go forward from this. But yes, that would be our best analysis, accepting that these data are imperfect.
Accepting as well that it's very hard to know what package of restrictions is optimal. This isn't a controlled experiment, Ed, where we can say, well, let's randomize countries to have 6 weeks of really hard lockdowns and then wide open compared to steadier, smaller swings. We just don't have those data and we can't call it.
As we look forward now, what in your findings do you think you want to make sure the public health officials, political people, and society at large use to inform the pandemic response moving forward? And at the same time, if I may, you know, we've seen a lot of politicalization. We've seen in certain leadership races going on in Alberta federally, where there's a lot of talk that under no conditions will mandate be reimposed. So I want to know what worries you. So let's start on the positive side. What are the lessons here that you really would like to see applied?
I'll start with a few, but I think there are a lot of takeaways from this. The first that I'll start with is that Canadian population has clearly shown that with messaging about the value of vaccines, the infrastructure to roll out those vaccines by getting to hard to reach groups like the elderly who are mobilized in buildings or marginalized groups that may not have time to go to a vaccine clinic. If you give them the information they need and you have a full court press, they will do their part and get vaccinated. But the third dose of the vaccine, which is the state that we're at now, where the majority of the population should have the third dose of the vaccine, instead of being at the very top of the G10, like we were for dose one and dose two, we are solidly middle of the pack now. So the population that has shown that they would be willing to do it is not getting those jabs. We have to improve our mechanism of conveying information, being transparent, getting the vaccine out to people. So there's questions about the infrastructure and the funding, for example, to get to poor neighborhoods or to apartment buildings where it's predominantly elderly who have trouble getting vaccine clinics. Those mechanisms have to remain in place. There is a lot of uncertainty about, well, there's a third dose and a fourth dose. Which one do I need? There has to be clarity of messaging around saying, look, this third dose is critical, but we are entering an era probably of new vaccines starting as early as the fall. And there's a real chance you may have to go out and get that fourth vaccine, not because science doesn't know what it's doing, but because this is a learning process where the virus is changing and we are adapting to do the best we can against what is circulating. So we haven't told the population, I think, Canadians clearly enough, that the version of the virus that we see today is so heavily mutated that it's no longer even a distant cousin in some ways of what we saw in early 2020. It is a profoundly different virus in terms of transmissibility and severity. And the vaccines that are changing and the need for the additional dosing is adapting to the virus, not an imperfection in the original strategy back in 2020. So those messages, I think, have not clearly made it out.
Okay, so if you haven't had your fourth dose yet, if I'm hearing you right, you might want to hang on until the vaccine formulation has caught up with the vaccine.
It's one of many difficult questions, and it's a fantastic question. I think that depends. I think for older Canadians, a fourth dose makes sense. And generally, that's been recommended by authorities, and I think it's a sound recommendation. But we also know many older individuals who are able to control their time a little bit better because they're out of the workforce or who, you know, are able for other reasons of privilege to do it, are going to probably do what you're suggesting. And that is, if they haven't had the fourth shot, they'll try to have a very quiet asocial summer and see if there's a bivalent or a new type of vaccine in the fall. You know, my advice to people who ask is, if you're out and about a lot, or if you've been planning to travel abroad and you're older, or you have other vulnerabilities, get that fourth dose. The bigger concern for me remains this lag on third doses, because we really see this in the Omicron era as a three-dose vaccine. And I think, unfortunately, what's happened is the enthusiasm in the early days was partly driven by a lot of evidence for reduced infection as well as protection against serious illness. And people came away with a view that these vaccines really were going to protect against infection as well as serious illness. Along comes Omicron. We still get great protection against serious illness, but a ton of people are getting infected, and it's not a pleasant infection to have. So you have a kind of loss of faith. And the instant invalidation of the concept of two-dose full vaccination vaccine mandate, suddenly that's shattered. So I think one of the lessons here is that we have to reset the narrative. We have to start talking about what happened clearly with Omicron. You still had great protection against serious disease. Future vaccines are going to be important to reinforce that protection. And if we get the formulation right, you'll also restore more protection against infection. But right now, what we have to do is protect people from getting really sick and dying, and we also protect them against long COVID. So big messaging reset needed for the government, starting with thanking Canadians for what they did and just going through where we are. Last point I'll make, like 60% of the population probably has been infected if you take full count, because it just keeps rising every week. This thing has not gone away. There's still a steady stream of people getting ill. And we don't know what hybrid immunity means from the standpoint of durability and breadth of protection. Some people are thinking, I've had an infection and a couple of shots, I'm okay. I'm sorry, you still need a third shot. We don't have enough information to be sure that that infection gives you durable and strong immunity. So that communication has to be done urgently over the summer, in my view, as part of any strategy. That's a crucial part of this.
I'm just weighing on this yourself for a second right at the end. How concerned are you that the social solidarity that carried us through a lot of this and the trust in public authorities and public health officials, that people are closing the door on that now, that they're kind of, the whole thing's timed out for them, in not even the people who are opposed to mandates, et cetera, even the people who are in favor, and that maybe we're becoming a bit complacent as we move towards the fall? Is that something that concerns you?
enormously. So the warning signals are flashing everywhere around this. It's the public polling that tells you that people's willingness to get a third dose has really plummeted. It's their willingness to go through another round of restrictions has really plummeted. It's practically being in enclosed spaces that are tightly packed with people, like a subway in Toronto, where you see maybe the majority of people are no longer wearing masks, even though they're face-to-face against each other. And we know that there's a huge amount of spread happening. There really is a nihilism, I think, that has settled in. And I think part of that is, and we hope part of what this article will help to highlight, is a lack of recognition of how much we've achieved collectively. I don't think you have this unrelenting pandemic for two and a half years now, and who wouldn't be fatigued? And like any great sports analogy or hero story, you need to know that you achieved something during this time. And I don't think the recognition of the achievement is broadly out there for people to rally around and to build towards the next step. And the final thing I'll say that really concerns me is what's happened to the healthcare system. So, you know, you saw an Andre Picard article this week talking about it's the collapse of the system on the immediate horizon. And that's not hyperbole. And it's not because of necessarily just ongoing infection. It's because there was a real human toll and sacrifice for that scramble that happened the last 2.5 years that is not sustainable. So you have these enormous capacity restraints. People went absolutely to the wall to try and make the system work. And they've done that for 2.5 years. And now they just don't have it in them to continue to do it. So you're getting massive absences. I have a colleague who's one of the most decorated physicians at the entire university, who's in his 50s, who just stepped away from medicine a couple months ago and said, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. At the apex of his career, is stepping away. And that kind of story is unfortunately no longer rare. We're hearing that all over the place. Nurses are retiring. Doctors are stepping away. We're running out of MRI technicians so that major hospitals don't have MRI capacity overnight. So this is just happening everywhere. And if we get hit by an enormous fall wave, I don't think the reserve is there the way it was the first 2 years to deal with it.
I want to thank you both, Fahad Razak, Scientific Director of the COVID-19 Ontario Science Table, and David Naylor, Professor of Medicine at the University of Toronto. I thank you for speaking with us today. Thank you for the study and all of the insights and the bottom line that, you know, Canada has done pretty well against its peers. There's things to learn. And thank you as well for keeping us on our toes. Hopefully it's over, but it's probably not over. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
At this point, we always like to do a shout out to one of our very esteemed PPF members. And today we want to declare how PPF proud we are of our member Enbridge for having received the Catalyst Award, which recognizes organizational diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that drive representation and inclusion of women. With their Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Accessibility Strategy, IDEAS, and Integrated Equity Plans, Enbridge has created a corporate culture that integrates DEI initiatives at all levels of the company. So congratulations to Enbridge for receiving this prestigious award and for being a leader in advancing opportunities for women and underrepresented groups. And that is a wrap. Thank you for tuning in. Please share this episode with a friend and feel free to leave us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. Let us know what you want to hear on Policy Speaking, particularly coming up in the fall. And I want to thank my colleagues at the Public Policy Forum who make this podcast happen. Thank you all. I'm Edward Greenspan, and this has been Policy Speaking.